Ladies and gentlemen, colleagues, students, and visitors to the LSE, welcome to this debate, Reproduction, an Issue of Human Rights. My name is George Gaskell. I'm Associate Director of BIOS, the Center for the Study of Bioscience, Biomedicine, Biotechnology, and Society. Now, before I make a few introductory comments about this debate and about our speakers, I am informed that I need to make two essential announcements. One is, if you have a mobile phone on you, would you care to take it out and ensure that it is switched off? Ensure that it is not on silent mode. Apparently, the technology that is being used to record this debate is completely confused by any reception of mobile telephony. So anyone, apart from my wife who phones in to ask where I am, will find themselves exiting the room if their phone goes off. Secondly, I have to inform you that the event will be recorded and made available for public consumption as a podcast on the LSE website. Brackets, the system should be launched later this term, close brackets. And under DDA guidelines, I have to say I have no idea who DDA is, the chairs of public events are encouraged to repeat any questions from the audience for the benefit of those with hearing difficulties. We'd encourage you to do that. Well, I do hope that people who ask questions will avail themselves of one of the roving microphones and speak very clearly. Right, well, this evening's debate, Reproduction, an Issue of Human Rights, is co-sponsored by the Center for Human Rights here at the LSE, and Conor Geerty is in the front row, and by BIOS, and the director of BIOS, Professor Sarah Franklin, is also in the front row. And we're delighted that you are all here. Now, it seems that reproduction has become something of an increasingly contested and controversial issue. One might say in olden times that it was a fairly straightforward business. In Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, as Benedict responds to the mockery of his friends, having announced his forthcoming betrothal to Beatrice, what does he say? The immortal words, "The world must be peopled." Into the 20th century, effective contraception brings the opportunity for sex without reproduction, and there followed IVF, which brought the opportunity of reproduction without sex. Both developments accompanied by controversy and debates around the legal issues, around religious issues, and around ethics. Now, human embryonic stem cell research, as reported in a paper by the National Research Council in the US, has led scientists and non-scientists alike, they say, to contemplate profound issues, such as who we are and what makes us human. According to one of my colleagues, Torben Nielsen in Oslo, embryonic stem cells have attained, along with cloning, the dubious status of the most promising as well as the most controversial among the many applications of modern biotechnologies. Now, to frame our debate this evening, I have the pleasure to introduce two eminent scholars and researchers. Dr. Stephen Minger is director of the Stem Cell Biology Laboratory and a senior lecturer in the New Wolfson Center for Age-Related Diseases at King's College across the road. With his colleagues, Dr. Minger was awarded one of the two licenses granted by the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority for the derivation of human stem cells. They developed the first line of stem cells in the UK and were one of the first to put these into the UK Stem Cell Bank. Professor Deborah Spar is from Harvard University. She's the Spangler Family Professor, an authority on the intersection between technology and policy and regulation. She is the author of this book, The Baby Business, which was published by Harvard University Press earlier this year and is in translation in 6 or 7 languages. Now, this book concerns the politics of reproductive science and analyzes how the baby business has developed, how commerce, politics, and technology have shaped this new market around infertility. Our distinguished speakers will talk for about 20 minutes each, and that will be followed by a question and answer session. So I invite Professor Spahr to take the floor.
Good evening. Thank you all very much for coming out this evening. It's a great pleasure for me to be here this evening. I want to say a special thanks to Professor Geardy and Professor Franklin, who've gone through a more than usual amount of trouble to work with my logistics to bring me here for about 4.5 hours. So thank you very much for your patience. The organizers have asked me to consider a single question for my remarks this evening. So let me repeat this question to you slowly and carefully. The question is, can markets be used to protect reproductive rights? I'm actually going to repeat that. Can markets be used to protect reproductive rights? Now, this strikes me as a particularly interesting question. And it's a wonderful question for an early evening on a rainy Monday when we want to sort of think about big and tough issues like that. It also strikes me, I have to confess, an awful lot like a setup. Because look what they've done here. They assemble a crowd of human rights people, bioethicists, they bring in a leading scientist, and then they fly over someone from Harvard Business School and ask them to talk about the market. This is the setup, I think. Because if you think about this question again, can markets be used to protect reproductive rights? The answer seems on the face of it to be completely and totally obvious. Of course markets can't protect reproductive rights. Markets are harsh and impersonal creations that are driven by concerns for efficiency and profit maximization. This is the LSE, we know that, right? Markets don't care about reproduction or rights, and they certainly aren't in the business of protecting either reproduction or rights. You would think this would be a very short talk, because the answer should just be no. But they've been kind enough to give me 19 more minutes, so I'm going to take the full 19 minutes to try to answer this question in the affirmative. So I am going to try and convince you tonight of this utterly counterintuitive proposition that markets can indeed be used to protect reproductive rights. Now, let me offer 2 caveats before I even start. I'm not fully convinced of this argument myself. And in my book, I do not, in fact, make this argument. But it seemed like such a good argument that I thought it was worth a try. And I'm going to throw out a logic to you, and then I will let you destroy it after my 19 minutes are up. I also will say that I am going to restrict my remarks this evening to talk just about the market for reproduction. So the market for parents who are trying to conceive. I think this market overlaps in very interesting ways with the emerging science of stem cells, but I'm not going to talk about that. And I'm going to leave that to Stephen to sort of pick up those pieces, if you will. So let me begin with a brief defense of markets and then move on to look more specifically at the market, the emerging market for reproduction, or what I call in my book the baby business. So let's start by defending markets. And I would begin this defense with exactly the same point I just mentioned as part of the typical critique of markets. And that is that markets are indeed harsh and impersonal creations. They are indeed driven by concerns for efficiency rather than the protection of any sort of rights. But that characterization, I would suggest, doesn't necessarily make markets bad or evil. It simply makes them neutral, both in a normative sense and with specific regard to the protection of human rights. Markets are not designed to protect human rights or destroy them. They do not exist to advance social goals. Instead, markets, as far as I understand them, are purely economic in nature, and all they do is bring together supply and demand through the impersonal mechanism of price. Now, for sure, we can all think of situations where the running of markets produces social bads. It produces ill effects for society. To give you one example, in the United States, one would argue, and in fact, I would argue, that the private provision of health care, providing health care through a market system, has pushed prices in many cases to unaffordable levels and undermined the right of poor people to enjoy good health. So that's an example where one can argue having a market denies people of some basic human rights. By the same token, I would also argue that sometimes markets produce social goods and protect human rights. For example, if you look at most life-saving drugs that have been created in the past few decades, they have come from massively commercial entities known as the pharmaceutical firms. These firms are clearly in the business of making money. That's what they do. But along the way, they've also managed to save millions of lives. And so that, in my opinion, is a market producing a social good, not because it's set out to do so, but because in the normal course of chasing profits, they happen to produce goods that also save lives. So I would argue that the development of markets in healthcare, for example, is not necessarily good or bad, protective or destructive of rights. Instead, markets in healthcare, like markets in pretty much every area, I would argue, will blindly do the only thing for which they are truly suited. They will match supply and demand, allowing firms to produce products and allowing customers to buy these products in turn. Sometimes this matching of supply and demand is good, sometimes it's bad. But it's difficult to argue in either case that the market itself is at fault, because the market's just doing what markets do in a very mechanistic way. I should say, just as a bit of a sideline, I've made this same argument in work I did over a decade ago now, looking at the impact of multinational corporations on human rights. When multinational corporations invest in the developing world, are they good or bad for human rights? And the answer, at least I've argued, is it depends. Sometimes multinationals invest and they drag along various practices with them, like prohibitions against child labor, like certain environmental regulations, which actually tend to improve human rights, and sometimes they tend to destroy human rights. It really depends. But in either case, the firm is not trying to change the landscape of human rights. It's just doing what firms blindly do, which is to pursue profits. So let me turn to the second point here, which is to look more closely at the reproductive market and to suggest that, if anything, markets for reproductive products or reproductive services are more likely to promote and protect reproductive rights than to harm them. Now, caveat, I actually think this is the toughest part of the argument to make, but I'm going to try it anyhow. And this is really sort of resorting back to basic economics. Because when you look at basic economics, which I'm sure all of you are either have studied or are about to study here, we know, both historically and theoretically, when markets are most likely to fail. We don't know in every single case, but we have a good idea when markets are not going to work well. For instance, markets are not very good, we know, at delivering public goods. Things like the lighthouse, the classic lighthouse example, or like clean air or clean water. These are things where the costs are borne by a small number of people, but the benefits are shared by many. They create a public goods problem, and markets aren't very good at dealing with public goods. We know that. We also know markets are not very good at producing goods drawn from common pool resources, things like salmon or cod in the North Atlantic. What happens in these cases is that markets work, but they tend to overproduce the commodity at hand, and they destroy the underlying resource. So in those two kinds of cases, we know markets tend to produce bad outcomes. However, reproduction, pretty clearly, I think, is neither a public good, in the normal economic use of the term, nor a common pool resource. In other words, if I create a child, that does not create a good for you. Regardless of how wonderful my kid might be, my child does not create a public good. By the same token, When I create a child, I don't draw on any common pool resource. Instead, it's the only product we know where you make it yourself. Or as my friend Melissa Williams, the political scientist, has argued, it's the one thing you make with things lying around the house. All right? So we don't have common pool resources to worry about. So technically, at least, we should, and I'm really just talking sort of economic technical here, we should expect a market in reproductive services or products to work pretty well. If the market can produce reproductive goods or services, people are going to want them, and there shouldn't be any bad effects created as a result. To take it one step further, we also know, basic economics, that competition in markets tends to increase supply over time and reduce price. It's what markets tend to do. So if we were to have, and in the U.S. we pretty much do have it, an active and vibrant market for reproduction, we should imagine that individuals are going to have greater access at lower prices to whatever reproductive options are commercially available. Now, this does not address the critical question of whether these reproductive options, the various technologies people can use, are themselves necessarily good for society at large. But it does suggest, again, basic economics, that enabling the market for reproduction to work will expand reproductive options, and in the process, it should expand the reproductive rights of those who have access to those options. Okay, my third point is to give you a little bit of history. And I believe, looking at the history of the past century, that we actually have some pretty good evidence to suggest that reproductive markets have helped to protect and expand reproductive rights. Now, another caveat, this is largely a U.S. story, and it's quite different from the U.K. story, but it's an interesting one, and I think it's most relevant to talk about this in the U.S. context because it is where you have the most active reproductive market right now. So think for a second about the issue of contraception. For decades, contraception was illegal in the United States. It was sort of less illegal here, but in the United States, it was explicitly illegal for decades and decades. People could not sell birth control, mechanical forms of birth control, and they couldn't even distribute information about mechanical forms of birth control because all of them were seen as interfering with the natural process of conception. But then in the 1920s and 1930s, activists like Margaret Sanger began to push for the law to be changed. And this is a long and complicated story, but there's a critical turning point in the story that most people don't know. The turning point occurred in 1937, when the American Medical Association reversed its decades-long position in opposition to contraception. And why did the AMA change their mind? They didn't change their mind, it appears, just because they began to think that they had made a mistake and maybe contraception was all right. They changed their mind because what Sanger did with the law was to push for a change in the law which made contraception illegal except if prescribed by doctors. For the doctors, this was a massive commercial opportunity. Now, I don't want to be completely cynical, and maybe they also thought this was good for women's health, but they also made a lot of money off it. In 1937, the AMA switches. All of a sudden, contraception becomes legal if prescribed by doctors, and the market takes off. Phase two of the contraception story in the United States, of course, is the development of the pill. And some of you may or may not know, the basic research for the pill was done in the 1940s and 1950s, but it didn't get out of the labs because it was so controversial and people were terrified of religious opposition. It was one woman, a woman named Catherine McCormick, who was the heiress to the McCormick Reaper fortune, who single-handedly funded the development of the pill. Once the pill was developed scientifically, she handed the technology over to Searle, a pharmaceutical firm, who clearly saw the commercial potential. Within a year of its introduction, the pill was the first blockbuster drug we know of. And the moral opposition disappeared. So I would argue creating the market for the pill created a reproductive right that we now take pretty much for granted, but which didn't exist until the market got involved. Third example is one that I imagine more of you are familiar with, and that's the development of in vitro fertilization, again, particularly in the United States. The early science of IVF was indeed non-commercial and funded by basic research funds, but once IVF became scientifically possible, once Louise Brown was born here in 1978, it was the market, hundreds of thousands of people clamoring for access to treatment, that pushed IVF into the broader community and expanded reproductive options. So the science by itself didn't create the option. It was the market. and the commercial demand for IVF that really enabled the science to develop, get better, and provide an option for now millions of people who otherwise could not have been able to conceive. Fourth point I want to make, and I should say that this fourth point actually contradicts to some extent the previous three, but I think it's an important point to make nevertheless. In the reproductive market, as I've been suggesting, commercial growth and expanded supply bring tangible benefits to the ultimate consumer, who I define as the would-be parents who can now become parents as a result of technologies and options developed in the marketplace. So the consumers are the parents. In this market, though, and here's where it is quite different from other markets, the consumers and the producers are not the only ones who matter. There are other people who get brought into this equation as a result of these technologies. And the two most obvious and important ones, of course, are the children created through these technologies and another class of producers. I tend to call them component suppliers, but the people who produce the eggs, the sperm, and the wombs that get wrapped into the production process. So let me just talk about the children for a second. If we think about technologies like pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which I think Stephen's going to talk about in greater depth, this is a technology that allows parents to go through IVF, screen the embryos, and determine at the embryonic stage whether an embryo contains a particular genetic mutation or not. So what parents can do if they know they carry the gene for, say, Tay-Sachs disease or cystic fibrosis, is they can choose to use these technologies and produce a child who doesn't suffer from these diseases. Arguably, and people can debate this, the parents' reproductive rights have been expanded as a result. They now have the right and the ability not to give birth to a child who is destined to die, which should be true for sure with Tay-Sachs. But what can we say about the rights of the child? Has the right of the child who's born through PGD been compromised in some way? That's a tough question. You know, I personally think not, but I agree this is a very serious and debatable question. What about children whose parents choose not to choose? If I can afford to do PGD, and I make sure that my children are all tall, intelligent, and good-looking, and yours are not, have your children's rights been compromised as a result of my choice? What about disabled people, who arguably now are going to have their traits chosen against? So are we undermining the right, say, of the deaf, if over several generations we all choose not to give birth to deaf children? Again, I will throw that out as a question because I think it's one of the most interesting issues raised here. Even more troubling issues arise around the component suppliers that I mentioned a moment ago. And they are the sperm donors, egg donors, and in the United States particularly, surrogate mothers who essentially rent or lease their wombs and carry babies for women or couples who cannot. Are the rights of these producers being compromised by the reproductive market? People have very strong views on this, and I anticipate and look forward to a fair amount of debate. But let me just sort of try and foment the debate by saying I don't think the answer is clear. I don't think we've really sat down and thought through the extent to which human rights may or may not be compromised by using people in this way as producers. At a basic level, though, I think the answer has to be driven by three considerations. Number one, and I want to underscore this because I think this actually slips out of the debate, is it safe? Before we even talk about rights in a more abstract sense, we need to think about whether or not these technologies are safe for the donors who donate their material and for the children they create. If all of these forms of donation are safe, then I think it's not clear that human rights are being compromised. However, if they're not safe, then I think it is clear that rights are being compromised, and particularly around the area of egg donation. I just think we need more research. We need to understand better under what conditions it is and is not safe for women to donate their eggs. Second consideration, are they being coerced? Are any of these producers being coerced by their doctors, by their friends, by their family, and by lack of information? And again, if they are being coerced in any way, this too, I believe, would constitute an infringement of their rights. And then the third consideration, and really the toughest one, I think, is to think about whether the sale of body parts inherently constitutes a violation of the seller's human rights. even if the sale is made willingly and without medical risk. My personal view is no. Maybe that's because I'm American, and I know it's, you know, we have a slightly different view of that, actually radically different view of that over here. But I think that as long as the procedures are safe, and I don't think we fully understand that yet, so I underscore it, and the contract's voluntary, the donation of sperm, eggs, and wombs does not necessarily classify as a violation of human rights. And this is a subtle but I think a very important point that I want to make, if it's not a violation to donate eggs, let's say, for £100, or to donate eggs for the price of lost wages, I don't think it becomes a violation if you increase the price. And this is the very important debate we're having in the United States right now, where there have actually been laws saying you can donate eggs for free, but it's a crime if you get paid. And I don't see the logic there. And this also becomes very important for stem cell science, where right now, if you're a tall Harvard undergraduate, you can sell your eggs for $35,000 for reproductive purposes, but you can't give them to Doug Melton or any of the other stem cell scientists and even get bus fare. I am sure that that is not logically consistent. Okay, so we can talk more about this, I hope, during the discussion period, but let me conclude with one final topic, and this is actually sort of the major point of my book. Occasionally, economists and other like-minded folks make what, to my mind, is the horrible mistake of assuming that markets exist in a vacuum and that the only role of government is to collect taxes and get in the way of business. If you spend time at Harvard Business School, that view becomes quite prominent, as you might imagine. I find that assumption to be totally misplaced, and I find it to be wrong in ways that are directly relevant to the topic we're discussing here tonight. Because, of course, no one is arguing, or at least I'm not arguing, that the reproductive market should exist without regulation. So there's a difference between having a market and having a completely free, unregulated Wild West market. In nearly all markets, even markets that are ostensibly free and freely competitive, governments exercise regulation to a less or greater extent. And it seems obvious to me in this market, given all of the issues I just laid out, that government needs to play a role. Government needs to create the rules that respond to this market and make sure that exploitation and violation of rights does not occur. Just to throw out a couple of examples, if a given society believes that gender selection is bad, so just in case you don't know this, in California right now, for $18,500, you can have a child of your selected gender guaranteed. You know, you may think that's good or bad. But if we think it's bad as a society, we can ban it, right? That doesn't mean we have to get rid of the entire reproductive market. We can ban that particular piece of it. Or we could subject it to some kind of a queuing system. If I want a girl and you want a boy, we're equal. If we all want girls or boys, then you have to wait. You know, it sounds a little bit absurd, but, you know, you can imagine a system like that working. If we think that certain kinds of reproductive technologies are dangerous, things like mitochondrial transfer, where theoretically you have a child born with the DNA of three people, or reproductive cloning, we can just ban them. So I think we need to get over this belief that it's an all-or-nothing proposition here. Conversely, if people believe that other techniques, like in vitro fertilization, are socially or individually beneficial, they can choose to subsidize them, much as the Danish government already does. You can have three free cycles of IVF in Denmark. You can have an unlimited number of free cycles in Israel because both of those governments now believe that IVF should be supported and subsidized. So let me end roughly where I began, with a plea for the impartiality of markets. On their own and in the aggregate, I think that markets can indeed advance reproductive rights, largely by expanding the range of reproductive options available to people and by facilitating access to these options through the mechanical operation of supply and demand. But markets don't operate in a political vacuum. And the only market that can fully protect reproductive rights is one that combines commercial forces with the tempering hand of regulation. So let me conclude there, and I'll look forward to your comments.
Slides. What do I do here? Da, 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 da. It's not going anywhere.
anywhere. Here we go. Sorry. Yes. It might be a little bit bright in here, but we'll see how this goes. So, again, like Deborah, I'm very grateful to the organizers and to Sarah and BIOS for the invitation. Deborah's made some very, very good points already. I'm a stem cell scientist. I have no background in reproductive medicine at all. But if you do stem cell research, particularly human embryonic stem cell research, you are by default forced into becoming a quasi-embryologist. And so I've been dragged kicking and screaming into the reproductive medicine debate. And I mean, Deborah's talked very clearly about sort of what the situation is in the U.S., and I would refer to it, particularly compared to the U.K., as the Wild Wild West. And I hope to show you some of the distinctions between what Deborah talked about and the situation that we have here. So I'll sort of talk about human stem cell technology, but I'll also try to focus it a little bit toward what currently the regulations are in the U.K. and sort of the ethics of embryo procurement, particularly in relation to stem cell research. Talk quite a bit about pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and at the end I wanted to sort of take you toward the future of where reproductive medicine and embryonic stem cells collide post-embryo. So just to put this into some sort of perspective, stem cells are unique cells that have the capability of giving rise to a wide variety of tissues and or intact organisms. So it's sort of a continuum of development. We know that the fertilized egg is the only, what we would refer to as totipotent cell. That is a cell that can give rise to everything. It can give rise to an entire human being. And then as development proceeds, stem cells become much more specialized. So if we focus down here at the embryo, say a 6 or 7 week old human embryo, we've already begun to develop tissues, liver, heart, brain, lungs. And if we go into the embryo at this stage, we can isolate what we call tissue-specific stem cells. So these are stem cells, say, from the heart. When we put them into a dish and under the appropriate culture conditions, we can expand those cells. They're heart-specific stem cells, and they can give rise to all the cells in the heart, but they can't give rise to brain, they can't give rise to blood, they can't give rise to bone. So they are restricted already at this stage to specific tissue compartments. Now, as development proceeds, most of these stem cell populations are either completely lost or really more or less disappear. You may have residual stem cells in some tissues, but in others, like the pancreas, for instance, we don't think there are any stem cells whatsoever, and that's why in somebody who has type 1 diabetes, their pancreas doesn't regenerate. But we do have some tissues, particularly bone marrow and in our intestines, where we have quite active stem cell populations, and these cells give rise to new cells every day. And to give you some understanding of how important this is, you have cells in your bone marrow that every second of your life generate 3 million new red blood cells. 3 million, 3 million, 3 million, 3 million, 3 million. If you live to be 100 years old, think of how many red blood cells those small number of stem cells generate over your lifetime. It's astronomical. So, you know, some of these stem cell populations are really important, as are these. But then there's this unique set of stem cells, which are derived from something called the blastocyst, which I'll show you some beautiful pictures of in humans in a moment. These cells are capable of giving rise to every cell type. So these cells generate these tissue-specific stem cells, which then become more and more restricted as time goes on. The problem with stem cells from fetal tissues and from adult tissues is that they can only give rise to the cells of that particular tissue, and in many cases, when you take them outside of the body and try to expand them, they will only expand for a certain number of cell divisions, and then they stop. Okay, so they're restricted in the types of cells they'll give rise to, and they're also difficult to maintain and to grow to large numbers. These cells, though, generate every cell type in the body except for the placenta, and we can grow them and grow them and grow them. And I'll show you data on that in a moment. So this just makes the point that the cells that we isolate and turn into embryonic stem cells come from a very discrete structure that exists for a very short period of time in development. In human terms, we're talking perhaps 2 days. And we isolate these cells before this process begins, which we call specification. That is, when these cells begin to differentiate into specific germ layers that give rise to specific cell types. So
So mesoderm gives rise to basically all the cells in the middle, the heart, the blood, bone, connective tissue. Endoderm gives rise to lung, liver, intestine, and ectoderm to the skin and brain. So we isolate these cells before this process begins to happen, when these cells are still completely uncommitted and express no markers of mature tissues whatsoever. And we trick them. We take them out of the developing embryo, we put them into culture, and I can talk about that later if you're interested how we do that. But these cells think they are still in the developing embryo. And because these signals have been blocked in some way, they just continue to expand. And they keep waiting for the signal to come to tell them to begin to differentiate. But when we do this and do it well, we can keep that from happening. And so these cells just keep expanding. And they expand, and they expand. And unlike other stem cell populations, which I told you will age in culture and stop expanding, these cells never grow old. It's almost like cocoon, you know? The cells never get old, they never go on holiday, they always remain young. They show none of the signs of changing that other cell populations do. So these are really unique cells. They don't exist anywhere else, okay? But that, the problem with that is that they come from very early human embryos. Now, Deborah alluded to sort of the history of IVF. IVF was created in this country by Robert Brown and Steptoe. They created the first IVF baby, Louise Brown, which we called a test tube baby back in those days. And this, I didn't realize, but at the time this happened, if you talk to Bob Edwards, who's still very active in this country and is still deeply involved in the stem cell and reproductive medicine field, these guys had to have round-the-clock police protection. People would throw bottles at them, eggs, their houses were, they had picketers outside. People were terrified of this technology. And the assumption was that we were playing with God. You know, God determines whether or not you can have a baby, not man. And it took a long time for this technology. You know, market forces did drive it, but at first people were really frightened of this. You know, where was this going to lead? And in the UK, there was a lot of opposition to this, and that more or less morphed its way into the government and into academic circles. And in 1985, Mary Warnock, now Baroness Warnock, led a consultation process to say, what are we going to do about this new technology? Where is it going? What is it going to lead to? What if people start genetically engineering embryos? What about designer babies? What about sex selection? You know, how are we going to regulate this? And unlike the U.S., where the free market just took over control of this, the government stepped in after the consultation and said, we're going to regulate this. And that regulatory body was created in 1990 or 91 called the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority. And since 1990, this body has regulated all reproductive medicine in the U.K., both privately and publicly. There's no distinction at all from the regulatory side of things about whether you're a for-profit or not-for-profit clinic. Moreover, not only do the clinics get regulated, but every single procedure that's performed in an IVF clinic in this country is regulated. So if you mix eggs and sperm in a dish, you have to have a license specifically for that. If you inject sperm into eggs, because the sperm are amotile and they can't move, so you can impregnate an egg by physically injecting sperm into it, you have to have a license for that. And I'll talk about PGD at a moment, which is even more heavily regulated than routine IVF. But the regulations have been here, and they've been consistent over the last now 16, almost 17 years. Moreover, since 1990, it has been permitted to use human embryos for research purposes. That is, embryos which have been created by IVF, which are excess to clinical need, that is, they're not used, and I'll tell you about a little bit more about that in a moment, or embryos which are of such poor quality that if implanted would not give rise, based on best clinical evidence, to a viable pregnancy, or embryos which are known to have genetic disorders, as Deborah talked about, which have been screened by pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Or you can actually create embryos solely for the purposes of doing research. Now, up until 2002, research on human embryos was restricted to these five areas here, which are all obviously related to reproductive medicine. What happened in 2001, 2002, which changed a lot of people's lives, particularly mine, was that the government decided, based on the first stem cell lines being created in 1998, 1999, that this country wanted to avail itself of this technology and push stem cell research forward. So there were votes in the House of Commons and the House of Lords to amend this original HFEA Act to now have two additional broad areas of research where the use of human embryos was deemed acceptable. That is, to use human embryos to attempt to understand significant human disease and the use of human embryos to develop therapies for significant human disease, i.e., generate human embryonic stem cells. Back in 2001, 2002, if you were somebody like me who was trying to gain access to human embryonic stem cell lines, it was impossible. We were told that it would be at least 3 years before we would get access to the existing cell lines. So if you wanted to do research in this area, it was a dead end. You just couldn't. The government stepped in and said, we're going to make this happen in this country. So I approached Professor Peter Brody, who's head of the Assisted Conception Unit at King's, and together with Susan Pickering, a human embryologist in his lab, we decided that we would apply for a license to the HFVA. And after, I guess, about 8 or 10 months, several court challenges, together with Austin Smith's group in Edinburgh, we were granted one of the first two licenses in the UK. To huge hoopla. I mean, I was amazed, actually, at the media response to this. It was completely overwhelming. But the licenses are very clear about what we can and cannot do, and this contrasts very significantly with the situation in the U.S. So we are allowed to use embryos which have been donated by informed consent from couples undergoing IVF. So I'll talk a little bit more when I show you pictures of the embryos, but basically, embryos are made in a larger number than can ever be used. Many of them are poor quality and generally discarded, but even from infertile patients, you will generally generate more embryos than can be used. And something has to happen with those. They either have to be frozen, they're discarded, or they can be donated for research. If they're donated for research, they're donated under what's called informed consent, where basically the families understand why we want to use their embryos to derive stem cell lines, what the ultimate fate of these are, and they sign away all rights to them. Once the embryos go into culture for stem cell derivation, the families lose all rights over anything that happens from that point onward. And if we send our cell lines, let's say, to a big pharmaceutical company, and they use them and develop a blockbuster drug, not only does none of that money come back to my lab, none of it goes back to the couple. They get nothing out of this. We can't offer them any financial or medical inducement for donating embryos for research. So we cannot offer them cut-price IVF, for instance, or move them to the head of the queue. They get nothing out of this whatsoever. And the government's been very clear about this. There can't be any coercion to encourage people to donate embryos for research. Our license at the moment doesn't allow us to make stem cell lines from embryos created specifically for that, but there is room within the Act for us to apply to the HFVA to have our license amended to do that. We haven't felt the need to do that, but it is possible. Importantly, there was a consultation process between the vote in the House of Commons and Lords in 2001 and the granting of the first licenses in 2002, which basically looked beyond just deriving human embryonic stem cells and said, what else should we do? And the government took up all these recommendations. One of the major ones was that there be a government-funded UK stem cell bank. And a stipulation of everyone's license, there are now 11 groups in the UK who are licensed to do this work. A stipulation of all of our licenses says that any stem cell lines that we make, whether we're publicly funded as an academic group or privately funded as is Roslyn, those cell lines have to be deposited in the UK Stem Cell Bank, and the bank will make them freely available to any research group in the world who requests access to those cell lines. And those cell lines are currently free. All you do is pay for the shipping. There are groups in the US and groups in Singapore who charge $5,000 and up for stem cell lines. And if you're a commercial company, you may have to pay as much as $1 million for a couple clumps of cells. All the stem cell lines that are in the bank currently, there are about 25 from the UK, are all available free of charge. And we get nothing for putting our lines into the bank. It's a requirement of our license. I think it's a fantastic resource that is the first stem cell bank in the world. Somatic cell nuclear transfer is legal in this country. There were two groups in the UK licensed to do what's called therapeutic cloning, that is, to use cloning technologies to create cell lines which are genetically matched to someone that you would want to use them for. And unlike most states in the US, where reproductive cloning is still legal, reproductive cloning in this country, that is, trying to create a live, living human being that is genetically identical to a pre-existing human being, that's completely banned in this country. The U.S. is one of the few countries in the world where this is legal. It's illegal in North Korea. It's illegal in Iran and Iraq. It's illegal everywhere else you can think of other than the U.S. And talk about free market economy. I find this just amazing. Right. So if you're going to make human embryonic stem cell lines, you need human embryos. And this is in vitro fertilization with human gametes in a dish. So this is a fertilized egg. This is immediately after fertilization. Now, the problem with IVF is that it is inherently wasteful. The big problem that we have is that we cannot freeze eggs. If you harvest, so you give a woman quite powerful drugs that instead of stimulating the release of a single egg, you may get 20. So we isolate all of those eggs by sticking a needle through the uterine wall. So this is invasive, it's uncomfortable, and the drugs are potentially dangerous, although the risks are thought to be, you know, fairly low. But it is an invasive, somewhat dangerous, not dangerous procedure, but it's certainly uncomfortable. And we don't know what the long-term effects of using powerful drugs like this are on long-term reproductive health. So it's not without risk. The problem is because we cannot freeze eggs and then thaw them with any real efficiency, we have to fertilize all the eggs. And so if you get 15 eggs, you may get 10 high-quality embryos. And what do you do with all of those? So in our clinic, so this is post-fertilization, we let the embryos go to day 3. For those of you who understand metrics, this is about 20 to 30 microns across. So this is almost barely discernible through a really good microscope. That's how small these are. The embryologists on day 3 will look at the embryos and they will score them. The best 2 embryos in our clinic are implanted, although we are trying to move toward a single embryo because our concerns about multiple births. And then any other high-quality embryos, we would encourage the couples to freeze. Because that way, if the first 2 don't that are implanted do not result in a viable pregnancy, we don't have to go back and go through the whole egg stimulation process again. We can just merely thaw 2 more embryos and implant those. Any other poor quality embryos here would generally not be would generally be discarded, because if they're poor quality here, they're not likely to give rise to a viable pregnancy. They're also not likely to progress to day 6, which is where we need to go to make stem cells. So in our clinic, the best embryos go to the patients. That is, they're either implanted or frozen. Poor quality embryos are generally discarded. So where do we make stem cells from? If best embryos go to the patient, the poor quality ones generally are discarded. You have to have a source of embryos. So there are only 2 sources, really. There are embryos which have been frozen, which have never been used, and at the end of 5 years in this country, those embryos have to, their fate has to be decided. They either have to be discarded, donated to another couple, used by the same couple, but if they've had a successful pregnancy, they may not want to use them. President Bush thinks that everybody who has embryos automatically donates them to somebody else and they become a snowflake baby, but in reality, very few couples donate embryos to other couples. It's not something they would rather have them destroyed than have them used by another couple. Or they can be donated for research. So the only source of embryos that we have used are small numbers of frozen embryos and embryos that come through this process. So as Professor Spahr pointed out, this is a technique which allows couples who are at high risk of passing on a genetic disorder to a child and who don't want to have a child with a known genetic disease. They come in, they undergo IVF, as I showed you, and on day 3, generally, we remove a single cell from an 8-cell embryo, and we screen each embryo using genetic techniques, and we determine which embryos carry a genetic disorder and which of those are unaffected. And unaffected embryos are then transferred to the woman or frozen. Okay? All the remaining embryos will be generally thought to be affected. Now, like everything else in reproductive medicine in this country, this is incredibly highly regulated. It is not in the U.S. Let's put this bluntly. In the U.S., if you've got money, you can use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to diagnose anything. If you think you have a gene that's responsible for intelligence and you can diagnose which embryos have one copy of the gene that causes better intelligence than the other copy of the gene which doesn't, and you've got the money, they'll do it for you. In this country, every single genetic disorder that you want to diagnose, you have to have a specific license for. So you notice there's a lot of diseases that aren't listed here. Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, motor neuron disease, many of those are genetic. They're not listed here because currently we don't have a license to do PGD for those specific disorders. So this is not screening embryos for all of these. You have to screen them for a specific disease that couple has in their family. So you can't do wholesale screening. You're looking for a very specific disorder. Now, to give you some idea of how absurd this can get, these translocations are chromosomal abnormalities which cause recurrent miscarriage. So the reason why people who have these don't get pregnant isn't because they're infertile, it's because their embryos implant and then miscarry at high frequency because their chromosomes are deranged. So each of these, you'll notice, is a different what's called translocation event where one piece of a chromosome breaks off and ends up on another one. And you notice that each of these are kind of different. We now have four pages, four A4s of different translocation events. For each of these translocation events, we have a separate license. So in our clinic, we have a wall that's massive that has licenses just for these. But there's nothing unique about these. They're all the same sort of chromosomal abnormalities. The only difference is which chromosomes are affected. And yet we have to have a license for if you come to us and you have a different translocation event, then we have to apply specifically to the HFVA for that event. You can see how this has gotten a little bit carried away. And what they now have said is that you can use PGD for translocations without a license for each specific event. So it's now become a little bit less bureaucratic. However, for these very specific disorders here, you have to have a license for each one of these. So our group has, now you might say, well, why would you want to use genetically lesioned or genetically disease-specific embryos to create stem cell lines? Because we want to create stem cell lines that have genetic disorders. We want to use those cells for drug screening and for trying to understand the pathophysiology of specific diseases because these are human cells. They're not animal models of disease. They're actually human models of disease. And if we can differentiate these cells into the relevant cell type, let's say for cystic fibrosis, if we can turn them into lung cells, or for Huntington's disease, if we can turn them into brain cells, that gives us a tool to develop new therapies, but at the same time try to understand why the disease happens. We cannot use PGD in this country for everything, and we certainly can't use it for sex selection. The only sex selection there has been is negative sex selection against diseases which only affect males. And then the males are discarded and only female embryos are implanted. But we are now moving away from that because we can now diagnose all the males into affected or unaffected as well. But you can see how tightly regulated this is. You know, in the US, you can use this technology to screen for any gene you want. All you have to have is the cash. And in this country, it is very, very, very tightly regulated. There is no free market here for PGD. Time to go. Okay. Let me just finish up by making a couple of points. So my lab has made a number of different cell lines. This was, I was going to tell you all the interesting things that we're doing. I just want to close and talk about cloning for 2 seconds and give you an idea of where this is going. So in this country, as I said, somatic cell nuclear transfer is legal. And what this requires, or what people commonly call cloning, are eggs, human oocytes. Now, what you do is you take an oocyte, you remove its nucleus, so it no longer has a genetic identity. And then let's say I take a cell from Deborah, a little skin biopsy, and I take one of her cells and I put it into this now non-genetic egg. It has no DNA in it whatsoever. Put her cell in, give it a zap of electricity, it begins to make an embryo just like I showed you. We get to this stage, I make a cell line. This cell line is now genetically identical to Professor Spahr. And so we could use those cells to treat her diabetes or her Parkinson's disease, and these cells would not be rejected, nor would we have to use immunosuppressive drugs. Okay? Now the big problem is where do you get eggs, and how many eggs do you need? Up until about a year ago, we thought we had this technology nailed down to an efficiency of about 10%. And then my good friend Professor Wang kind of ran into some trouble and, things got a little hairy and all of a sudden now we don't know if any of his data actually ever existed. The efficiency of this process at the moment we think is probably 1 in 500. That means to make one single cell line, I'm going to need 500 eggs. Okay? Now in the U.S., you just have to have a lot of money. At $35,000 a whack, probably get 10 to 15 eggs per donation. To get 500 eggs, you need about 25 or 30 donors, $35,000 worth of eggs. The bottom line is we don't know if this works yet in humans, now that Professor Wang's data has been mostly discredited. So our argument, and one that we've put forward and are applying to the HFVA soon, is not to use human eggs. If we don't know if this process works, let's use a different egg source. So which eggs do we use? Use non-human eggs. use cow eggs, rabbit eggs, pig eggs, sheep eggs. You've taken out their genetic identity, so they're no longer cows or pigs or sheep or rabbits. You put a human cell into them. You make an embryo. Is it a human embryo? Or is it a cowgirl or a cowboy or a rabbit bunny man? That was the other one, yeah. So, you know, but my argument, so the HFEA is under consultation at the moment about egg donation. Should eggs be donated for research? And this is one of the ways we're talking about using eggs for research. My argument would be we shouldn't be using donated human eggs for this type of research. Maybe for fertility research, yes, but certainly not for cloning research, because we just don't know if this works, okay? One other caveat is we could use eggs from a different source, which are human. And those are eggs that we make from human embryonic stem cells. Remember I told you that human embryonic stem cells can generate every cell type in the body. So if they can make muscle and they can make bone, they can make cartilage, they can make eggs, and they can make sperm. So we'd have a readily available source of eggs. We don't need to go to live human women to ask for eggs. We could just use the eggs that we make from human embryonic stem cells. So that sounds all right. Should we use those eggs and or the sperm that we make from human embryonic stem cells for fertility treatment? So with that, I'll stop. And I will just acknowledge the people in my lab. So these are the people who do all the work and all of our collaborators, and most of our funding comes from the Medical Research Council. So thank you very much.
Right, well, while Stephen catches his breath, if anyone has an appointment at 7:30, this is probably the right time to leave and shuffle out quietly. What I propose to do, ladies and gentlemen, is to take questions in blocks of, let's say, four, and I will pick people who raise their hands. I would invite you just to say who you are and where you come from. And may I suggest that we stick to shortish questions, and that any grandstanding or personal soapboxing is left to other fora. So, questions, please, to our eminent and splendid speakers. Connor, first one.
Thanks. Connor Gierty. I want to just put a couple of human rights points, really. I guess a lot of people are uneasy about what we hear unfolding, and then you try and understand why you're uneasy. And if you're somebody who's kind of religious, and you see these people as in the image of a God or a Christ or something, then I can see why you're uneasy. But human rights people are probably uneasy too. And I'm trying to work out, as I listen to you, and I'd like your comments on it, maybe, why they're uneasy. And I think human rights people would be uneasy, if they are, and I am. I'm uneasy about it. Because our subject, I think, stands or falls on our capacity to esteem people and respect them, whatever their attributes. And therefore, we need to be relaxed about their attributes and to be absolutely willing to enjoy them and admire them, whether or not they are attractive, have blonde hair, blue eyes, whatever it is. And that actually what I heard was a very strong attack in some ways in its potentiality on the foundations of a secular brand of human rights. So that's one thing just to ask about. And the other, I was listening to Deborah on the contraception and the market and everything. Well, actually, human rights has made a big contribution to non-reproduction. So you talked about the contraceptives. And, of course, the big thing from the lawyer's point of view is Griswold and Connecticut. And then it's followed by Eisenstein, I think it was called. And that's where the American Supreme Court saw, and this is the second, I will be short, George, saw a right to privacy in the Constitution, which for tonight's purposes could be called a human right. And then before you know it, Roe versus Wade, there was a right to terminate pregnancies in the way that Mr. Justice Blackmun determined. Now, a lot of people were very upset about that because it seemed to steal their language the life of the unborn, the right to life of the unborn, had been transformed by the right to terminate life of the parent. And this is being played out here again when Amnesty are pushing hard, and it's very controversial, for a new policy which is in favour of reproductive freedom. And quite a lot of the science that Stephen was talking about is actually alerting a new generation of people to maybe good human rights arguments, why we should be very nervous about tackling, about broadening and liberalising abortion laws. So, I mean, they're just two human rights angles that in due course I'd love to hear a response to.
I think given that Professor Geertie is the head of the human rights group and is co-sponsor of this meeting, I'm going to have an exception for him and invite Steve and Deborah, if they'd like to comment, come back on that one.
All right. Can people hear me? All right. They're great questions. Well, let me take them in not quite the order in which you pose them, because I think the toughest one is the one you raised first. On the issue of privacy, you're of course exactly right that in the United States, the access to contraception and access to abortion have been defined largely through the lens of privacy. And there's a great deal of debate now about how far that privacy definition will go, if it's ever called into question, in dealing with things like PGD. So if couples have the right to determine what happens in the marital bedroom, does the marital bedroom now extend into the laboratory? Presumably yes, because we've given couples and individuals now, as the technology advances, the right to determine not only when they'll become pregnant, but with what kind of qualities, perhaps, attached to the pregnancy or to the child. So if we're going to start outlawing things like PGD, we will also almost certainly be putting at risk at the moment, guaranteed access to abortion. And I think this is one of the reasons why the U.S., somewhat ironically, is such a Wild West. It's because no politician wants to touch this area, because you inevitably get dragged into abortion. And just to be perhaps even more provocative here, at some level, if you really believe that conception begins at the moment the egg touches the sperm, then you can't do any of the things that Stephen just described. So at some, you know, in some ways, the advancements in reproductive medicine are politically going to challenge abortion, which is why nobody wants to touch it in the United States. So I think that question is actually, it's complicated, but politically the answer is simple. I think the first point you raised about the way in which all of these technologies call into question how we value human life, I think that's a very serious critique. And I agree with you. I worry about parents micromanaging the genetic characteristics of their children. I really do. I don't worry about parents not having a child with Tay-Sachs disease. And I think people presume, including my esteemed colleague Michael Sandel, that this is a slippery slope, that if we allow people to select against Tay-Sachs, we'll go tumbling down the slope and all of a sudden we'll be picking from this reproductive supermarket. I don't think that's true. I think we can draw a line. And again, I know that it's been making Stephen crazy, but I think the British approach is not entirely bad, that you can choose for things that make medical sense, but you can't choose for things that are frivolous in some way. So I think it's a really tough question, but I think actually that we can tackle it.
And I'll just really comment on the first question. I think I take a lot of solace in the fact that we do have such a tight regulatory system here. It does make me a little bit crazy at times, but actually I wouldn't trade it for anything else. I think we have a model environment for regulatory environment for how we should do this work, because even people who are opposed to this research, and I know many who are, at least accept the fact that it's very, very tightly regulated in this country. We have to account for every egg that's used, every embryo that's used. PGD in this country is restricted to selecting against embryos with genetic disease, and that's it. We have had no savior sibling cases, that is, using IVF to try to create an embryo which is in some ways immunologically matched to a pre-existing child, and then use that child's bone marrow or cord blood as a means of saving a pre-existing child. This is very common in the U.S., and it may take hundreds of embryos to get a good match. And we have not allowed that in this country, and I think the HFVA should be applauded for that, because I also agree with Deborah. In some sense, this could lead to a slippery slope, and what you have to have is appropriate regulation that says we will use this technology for this because we think it's appropriate to not generate children or try to attempt to not generate children which have, you know, quite catastrophic genetic disease. We have not used PGD for frivolous purposes, as I think I've pointed out. And so, therefore, I feel quite comfortable with this regulatory environment, and I'm opposed to any pressures that are put on the HFVA to relax this. I think this is appropriate regulation without being excessive.
My name is Sundberg. As much as I enjoyed both addresses tonight, I feel that we've been cheated almost out of a debate. And I suppose in that I would have liked to have seen an ethicist on tonight's panel. Dr. Minger, you spoke a lot about the grounds in terms of HFE Acts and the principles underpinning that, and a lot about the process, a lot about the product in terms of where we're going with it, the slippery slope and so on. But there's been no emphasis on the actual process and the rights and wrongs of that. And so my question is just to speak to that. And I suppose it's, what are we saying as a society when we use the human embryo, genetically human, will never be anything other than that, to pursue our own medical and scientific possibilities? In a sense, it's our own fantasy that we're pursuing with this, and it's just the means of which we achieve that. I would just be interested to hear a little bit more discussion on that.
There's a lady in green over here, but could we go to Professor Emily Jackson from Queen Mary's College, who was on the HEFE and as a lawyer and might address some of the questions posed by the previous person.
Thanks, George. I was just very, very struck by something Deborah Spahr just said about not wanting to let parents micromanage their children. And I think in relation to that, there's a really interesting contrast between what we allow parents to do after birth, when they certainly do micromanage their children in all sorts of ways, and they're not expected to be accepting of every character trait in their parents, in their children, and maybe hothouse them, give them extra tuition. And before conception, when I think, interestingly, we hold parents to a much higher standard, their parents before conception would be parents, are supposed to possess this virtue of being entirely accepting of their children's character traits. So there's a very high standard there. After birth, you just have to be a good enough parent, and you don't actually have to be that accepting at all, and be quite rigorous with your children. And I just think there's a really interesting contrast in the way before conception parents maybe are being held to a much higher standard than afterwards.
Lady at the back in green. Sorry, I'm slightly colorblind, so if I call out a color, it may be only an approximate one. A genetic defect, I'm afraid.
I had a question about something that you, Dr. Spahr, mentioned specifically, but I'm interested to hear what both of you think. You had talked about how with stem cell research and with this issue of reproductive rights and markets contributing to it, how it can be allowed if people's rights are not suppressed. And you mentioned how with the development of certain technology, there are certain traits that can be removed. So for example, Down syndrome or deafness or someone being blind. And concurrently, there has been this just a handicap in that sense that since we couldn't prevent these sort of genetic deformities, that we had laws protecting these rights. So we have Braille under room numbers, and we have schools where deaf people can go. Now, if this market promotes reproductive rights and allows more people to have access to them, and markets can obviously equally have access equally for all social classes, do you see the phasing out of certain characteristics as an infringement on people's rights, on deaf people's rights, or people who have genetic disorders, their rights? Or do you see this as a teething problem of reproductive rights becoming a facet of the market?
I don't see any other hands at the moment, so Deborah, do you want to...
All right, these are all wonderful questions, and I may actually sort of bundle some of them together. Let me start with this fascinating issue of micromanagement after birth, because I think you raise a really important point. Parents now, and I fear it's even worse in the States than it is here, you know, start playing Mozart in utero. There's entire companies that will program, you know, music for the fetus. The tutoring industry to get your kid into the right, not only the right university, but the right preschool now is, you know, astonishing. And it's very easy to be cynical about this, but you raise a very good point, and it relates to the first gentleman's question as well. We as parents, for better or worse, do not seem to be willing to just accept our children necessarily for what they are. You know, we want to tweak and pull them and you know, mold them in some way. And, you know, it's not clear to me how far down that path we're going to go. But it is a little bit unfair to say you can do whatever you want post-birth, but you must sort of hold yourself to, Michael Sandel has a beautiful phrase that I can't recall at the moment, but the sort of unbidden acceptance of the unknown, that you take whatever child nature provides you. So I think for sure there is a conflict there. One of the things that I feel most strongly about is that at the moment, we know almost nothing about how parents actually would make choices. And I think that's a problem, because we're guessing. And I think we tend to, and this also relates to your question in some way, we tend to presume the worst, that people given a choice will all want tall, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, the sort of old Nazi ideal that raises these horrible thoughts of eugenics. I'm not sure that's true, and one of the projects I'm working on now, if I can get them to give me all the data, is looking at what characteristics people actually choose at sperm banks. Because we now have sort of 30 years, there's enough data, and we want to try and match the data and see if blonde sperm gets chosen by blonde recipients or by all recipients. I'm using sort of a characterization here. If short couples look for short sperm or tall sperm. And I mean, it sounds sort of silly, but I actually think this is really important, because if it turns out that people are using these technologies to essentially try to replicate the child they would have had naturally, I actually don't worry about it. If they're using them to try and create super children, I worry a lot more, and I just don't think we know yet. Let me just come back to your point in conclusion. I worry about this a lot. That we would, if everyone selects against Down syndrome, which, let's be honest, is a fairly common thing. People are already choosing against Down syndrome. They're doing it through ultrasound and abortion. But for sure, PGD makes that easier. I do worry an awful lot about the fate of children and adults with Down syndrome. But I think, again, that's something we can make sure to build protections in for. And over time, for certain sets of diseases, the problem will go away. I mean, for things like Tay-Sachs, where there's a clear genetic component and it's pretty easy to select against, we should just see fewer and fewer of those cases. But there's sort of a problem in the transition period, without question.
So I'll attempt to respond to the first question, because I think it was more or less directed at me. So I think a number of things revolve around this. I think one of the strongest arguments for the permitted use of embryos for stem cell research comes from the Select Committee's report, House of Lords Select Committee report, following the consultation in 2002. And there, I think exhaustively, they looked at the moral status of the embryo in development and came to the conclusion that because large numbers of embryos are destroyed during the process of IVF, they're destroyed and discarded simply because IVF is so inefficient at the moment, that if the appropriate regulations are in place and couples feel motivated to donate embryos for research, and this is my own personal view as well, I think it's certainly much better to utilize them in attempting to create therapies which won't help me, probably won't help you, but will help other people somewhere down the road. And I liken it very much to organ donation at death. This is tissue which will be discarded, and you can either put it down the sink or put it in the bin or put it in the grave or cremate it, whatever you want to do with it, or you can do something that may be beneficial. And I think that's a personal decision that the couples make if they choose to donate or not, and many of them choose not to, and that's their right. I have no involvement with the couples who donate or not whatsoever. It's my decision as a scientist whether I want to do this research or not, and I do. I think what I'm doing has some value to society, and I certainly would believe that making stem cell lines and trying to develop therapies for a wide variety of diseases is a better utilization of embryos than just putting them in the bin. And I think the vast majority of people in this country agree with it. The government certainly agrees with it, and it's my personal decision to pursue this kind of research.
Can I just make one more comment, because you reminded me of something? When organ transplantation first began, it was seen as completely immoral and unethical. And I think if we had had a debate about organ transplantation then, I'm actually doing some research on this at the moment, you see very much the same arguments that a bioethicist would have made tonight about not using human parts as instruments to save another person. And I'm sympathetic to those arguments, but I also think that ethics change over time. And we now have, in fact, gotten very comfortable doing things like IVF, like organ transplant, like vaccinations, like open heart surgery, all of which at the moment of their creation were seen as being inherently unnatural and exploitative. So I think the ethics, it's hard to acknowledge that ethics evolve, but I think they do.
Gentleman over here.
The lady in the middle here.
James Lawford Davis, I'm a lawyer working in this field. I think the market for reproductive technologies is international rather than national, particularly in Europe. It'll cost me £8 to get back to St. Albans tonight, but I could get
could
to Vienna for...
Just speak up a fraction. Just speak up a fraction.
Sure. Shall I start again? Or...
Yes, please.
I was just saying I think the market is international rather than national. You can travel around, particularly around Europe, very, very cheaply these days. And we don't know how many people move around for treatment, but we do know that lots do. And I think that's particularly important when you look at countries that, rather than regulating reproductive technologies, have chosen to prohibit them absolutely. So PGD, for example, is not permitted at all in Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Italy, Ireland, for whatever reason. And so thousands of people are leaving there for treatments wherever they choose to seek it. So they might end up in Belgium, they might end up in Guy's, or they might do a Google search and end up, goodness knows where, receiving whatever treatment in whatever language with no counselling, no preparation, no follow-up. And I think that in itself has huge implications for their rights and the rights of those who are put into that situation. And I'd be really interested to know what you think about how those sort of countries should enter into the debate about reproductive rights. But also, just to link it into the question of micromanaging children after birth, what's particularly interesting about most of those countries is that they don't regulate or barely regulate prenatal diagnosis and abortion. So in Germany, you can terminate pretty much whenever you like, for whatever reason, but you can't do PGD. And that, again, I think is a really curious question and characteristic that we have in Europe at the moment.
Interesting. Is this working? Yeah, there you go. I hope I don't sound too naive when I say this. I'm quite young, and I'm not actually planning on having children in the near future, so if you ask me this again in like 10 to 20 years' time, my answer might be very different. But I'm curious as to whether the evolution of IVF itself was a response to someone seeing that there was actually a potential market there for parents who couldn't have children, and if it really is a human right to actually have your own child, is that a right in its own, in itself? Or is it the fact that you were trying to better humans that were already living? Because from what I've seen and from what I've read in the past, I can only see IVF as a very materialistic 21st century I want it all attitude. And it's become a design, they are known as designer babies, babies that 30-year-old women who have everything else that they want, but you know they don't have a baby and suddenly decide at 35, oh my God, I need a child. And it just seems to be so illogical to me as to why all of a sudden they have rights to have this child when they're denying it a father or what else ever, you know, normal children have. I'm from a generation where most of my friends are all actually embarrassingly mistakes. you know, and we just kind of happened, and, you know, happened to our parents, and they've had to adapt. But people are starting to plan to have their babies now, and it doesn't seem to be a natural thing, and it seems to be much more like the 21st century. This is what it's telling people to do. Instead of trying to better the human race and improve those that are living, we're bringing more and more people into the world than we can actually handle. And then you're going to have to end up asking yourself, is there a market for euthanasia? Is there a market for ending life, not just bringing it? Because who is right is it to decide anyway?
Thank you very much. The third question in the triptych from... have you inadvertently switched it off? Has the battery run out? Could we have the other
Hello?
One?
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, no, it's working.
Just to follow on, whether reproduction is a human right, should you have to pay for it? Or should you be able to get it for free? Everyone in England complains that the NHS is going bankrupt, yet we're paying for women to have IVF treatment. Should it not be going to other causes?
Controversial stuff.
All right, I'll start with the international piece, because that's easy. It's easy to answer and really hard to actually do. But you're entirely right. This is I actually wrote an article on this a couple years ago. There's an international market for what's now called reproductive tourism. And it's particularly strong in Europe because airline tickets are so cheap. It's also, this will sound silly, but it's a very easy thing to import across borders because nobody can see it. So if you go to Spain for some eggs, you don't report it on the customs form when you fly back through Heathrow. Spain is becoming a big market for the services, oftentimes with eggs coming from Eastern Europe. Romania and Ukraine, along with Russia, are becoming real hotbeds for the reproductive component. I think this is a big problem. For all the reasons you outlined, there's no standardization. You worry a lot about the health risks. You worry about the safety risks. You worry about the exploitation of particularly the young women involved. The only way to solve this is through the messy process of international coordination and particularly EU regulation. And if we look at other areas of, you know, global governance, even going back to things like bank standards or environmental standards, there doesn't seem to be any easy way to get there. You sort of have to start with national level regulation and then spend years in Brussels and then eventually in, you know, various boring international conventions slowly building up regulatory standards. But I don't see any other way around it. I mean, I think we'll get there, and I think the EU is going to be the critical player here because you already have mechanisms for slowly getting towards some kind of European standards, and it will happen here. And you're also right, there's a big split right now between the sort of the Germany-Austrias of Europe and the Scandinavian sort of UK countries. But I think there's some standards starting to emerge, things like not allowing multiple births. So it'll be a slow but a messy process, but it's the only way we eventually have to go. Let me deal with these two, which I think are not, in fact, naive questions at all, but are really important questions and actually good questions to end on. I don't know if people have a right to have a child. I don't know if people have a right to have their own genetic children. I don't know if people have a right to have a child at 53, at 68. I mean, this has been one of my favorite questions to ask fertility doctors, U.S. fertility doctors. And I'll say, would you help a woman who's 43 get pregnant? Of course. How about a 58-year-old? Yeah. How about a 62-year-old? And their answers are generally, well, you know, if she was healthy and she had just had a son die in a motorcycle accident, I don't think a 62-year-old woman has a right to a child. But we have to actually think about these rights. And this is where Connor and folks who are human rights scholars have to enter the debate. In the U.S., we've established a right to privacy, but not a right to a child. And I think we need to think about that. If people have a right to a genetically related child until they're 39, or however we define it, then we have to make sure that we subsidize that right. So at the moment, because we haven't defined it as a right, we can sort of get away with not providing access. But I think once you clarify the right, then you need to worry about access. The final point, which you didn't mention, but I will throw out, I also worry about the other side of this, which is what in cruel economic terms you'd call the substitute market. And that's existing children. I worry a lot that people who previously would have thought about adoption now can spend years and years, and in the United States, thousands of dollars pursuing a genetic child rather than an existing non-biological child. And at some point, if you're going to get your sperm from another source and your egg from another source and your womb from another source, I'm not sure why you just don't adopt instead.
Just a very quick response that is slightly different than the questions, but in response particularly to James's question, it's not just reproductive tourism, it's regenerative tourism. Yeah. And, you know, there are clinics in Barbados, for instance, which are using aborted human tissue collected from the Ukraine, abortions in the Ukraine on a voluntary basis, of course. That tissue is flown to Barbados and is used to treat Westerners who, you know, suffer from a variety of ailments. And one of the common ones is, you know, I'm middle-aged, I feel a little run down, I need a little bit of a top-up. So they kind of get an embryo infusion, and they feel much better. There are clinics. There's a clinic in Rotterdam that you may have just heard about that was bringing in cord blood from the U.S., which they were procuring, it turned out, from a company that was selling it for research purposes only, not for human therapeutic use. I hope that that company has now been shut down because they were giving basically cells, contaminated cells, to patients. They transplanted hundreds of patients with God knows what material. There are rogue clinics being set up all over the world to exploit this. Some of it uses cells from cord blood, some of it will use cells from elective terminations, and some of it is already in India. There's a clinic saying that they're using human embryonic stem cells of God knows what source to treat almost any person who walks in the room. As much as we need regulation worldwide around reproductive medicine, I think it's absolutely essential that we also have some sort of regulation around these therapies, which in many places are completely unregulated. And again, I know I get up and I wave the UK flag a lot, but none of these therapies are available in the UK, and nor are they likely to be anytime soon. And I think it's important for those of us in this field who work in this very tight regulated environment to point out when we think this is occurring and try to bear some weight on getting them shut down in the countries that they're in.
Well, I think we've hit 8 o'clock, and it's probably better to close on a note where there's still some questions and still a lot of interest around the room rather than to sort of peter out. For me, this has been an absolutely fascinating evening. We've been presented with two very accessible challenging, provocative talks from the social science perspective and the perspective of the biological sciences. I think it shows how important is the intersection between the bio and the social sciences. These developments in new technology raise a whole series of economic, ethical, social, and legal dimensions which need to be addressed. So I hope you will express... Oh, and I should thank you all. You've been a most attentive audience, and I thought some of the questions were really absolutely first class, very provocative in nature. So I hope you will join me in thanking our two splendid speakers, Deborah Spahr and Stephen Minger, for such accessible and enjoyable presentations, and for taking all these questions on the chin and providing some further insights for us into this controversial area.
Thank you very much, Stephen and Deborah. I'm at the Centre for the Study of Human Rights. Normally at this point in the proceedings offers everybody a free drink or drinks. We can't tonight, I'm really sorry, because all of the main reception areas are being used to greet our new customers, I mean students. So the temptation for you is to come to our next big public event, which is on the 24th of October, which is about another relatively complicated ethical issue, what to do about China and human rights. So it's on the 24th of October, and we guarantee that if you say you're here, and the way you'll know is you'll be able to refer to these various people who are still here, and then that'll be the password for even better drink.
So we hope to see you at many of our events in the coming term, and in particular on the evening of the 24th of October, China and Human Rights. But thank you very much to all of you.